Ah, well, here is my first podcast recording. I have been quite fearful of recording my voice for quite some time. Obviously, I have no qualms with sending it to people in voice messages, but actually recording something intended to be put on the internet for the whole world to judge. I cannot think of anything more scary. But I don't mind putting pretty pictures of myself up. So that's something to analyze. So I initially intended this podcast to be called I Am Humanity, or 'Cause I'm Humanity. I think I'm going to stick with that for now. I decided to call it 'Cause I'm Humanity because I really wanted to challenge when people would come with their narrow views informed by popular culture, by their education, when I, a person, stands out from what they believe to be the cultural norms, the racial norms, the religious norms, the socioeconomic norms, the sexual norms, all of those things. When I present a challenge to that, they will ask me, but why do you do this? How can you do that? Why can you do that? And I suppose my most subtle, most eloquent, elegant response would be to say, because I'm humanity. Now, I haven't been using that turn of phrase in the past few months, but I think with the publishing of this podcast, this very first podcast, maybe that will be a reality. I'll start saying, because I'm humanity, say it out loud to the world. So I suppose a little update on what I've been up to for the past few months. I think anybody who follows me would have seen there's been a shift in what I've been posting. It's taken on a much more political glide. I like that. I've taken more of a political glide. So I've been gliding into being political, gliding into, I think, one of the most important things I've been gliding into is the calling out of white supremacy and how people are complicit in it every single day and how that seeks to make your life worse whilst improving theirs, or if not even improving it, just protecting whatever they think is a good life. And I knew as I started to post it that I was going against a lot of norms, against a lot of unspoken rules, and I knew that it would be getting a lot of white people quite uncomfortable, and it has. Since I started posting about white supremacy, calling it out, actually demanding white people to be accountable for their behavior, because if we do read an article about how the terrible things that happened in Charlottesville, the terrible things that are happening every single day in the name of white supremacy in America and in this country and in the rest of the world, but definitely got a lot of US happenings in my mind, then what happens is white people are able to say, ah, well, that's those people and this is so sad, I really don't like this. But when you actually demand them to be accountable for why they aren't protesting against it, why they aren't holding other people up accountable for it, why they're not holding themselves up as accountable for these learned behaviours or these ancestrally inherited behaviours, they begin to become very defensive and they start to come in together and groupthink and they start to attack whatever is the source of this demand for enlightenment. So I've had messages from people who I would have formerly called friends questioning my sanity. Are you feeling quite all right here? The more you're posting, the more the months go on, the more I'm concerned for your mental well-being. Do you have the adequate spiritual well-being, mental support? And this is what we call gaslighting. Gaslighting, which actually comes from a film from the 1940s where a Victorian husband does all these manner of tricks to keep his wife subordinate and controlled. He turns the gaslight up, so she begins to believe that she's insane. And then when she mentions the gaslights going up and down and up and down, he says, "Darling, I don't know what you're talking about. I think you ought to have a sit down." So this is now used to apply to toxic behaviours that are made to make this other person who was perfectly sane appear insane in order to protect that person's ego, protect that person's toxic behaviours, and ultimately so they can go on living without any change. So this is something I've noticed, and also with help from a lot of my black friends, politically woke black friends, you know, I've had interventions from them, not really interventions, a strong word, but, you know, words of strong advice about how these structures do play in, and also how I unwillingly, unwittingly would have been used in white people's saviorism complex. So, of course, having a beautiful mulatto as a friend, you know, with a lovely little white nose, which I've talked about in my posts, and a fluency in white culture and white parlance, why that is a lovely thing to have in one's life, because that's unthreatening, and they can embrace all of the beauty and richness of an African body without having to actually look at themselves and look at how they do contribute to white supremacy, how they act as agents of white supremacy. And I think if we could imagine, say, a chessboard, and the people you run into who are what we call nice people, nice with a capital N, they do not go out and call people niggers in the street. They wouldn't dream of doing such a thing like that, because they're nice people. However, they will make comments that demean people of colour. They will make choices that actively exclude people of colour. But of course, because they're nice people, they get to hide behind that. So if you imagine a chessboard, those people would be the pawns on the chessboard. And the people behind, the pieces behind, we've got the knights that get to move in a certain way, and then we've got the rooks who move in a certain way, and we've got the queen who can do whatever the hell she wants. If you think of it in that way, we'll see that the people at the front are still fighting in the name of white supremacy, but they are mainly doing the bidding of these other figures with more power. And of course, whoever controls the board, they're the ones who are really controlling what's going on here. So becoming aware of these power structures and how they affect my everyday life, it's actually been immensely liberating. Before, I was living in this kind of horrific, constant state of PTSD from white people's verbal violence. And now, since I've been much more outspoken about it, I actually feel more comfortable around white people. Because as a person of colour, being in a white-dominated area, you do feel worried, you do feel at edge. And of course, if you say this to a white person who has invited you to their house and all their family is white, a certain kind of white person will take offence and say, "Are you accusing me of something? I hope you're not." When actually it's from lived experience, and it's really animal instinct. When you spot something of danger, you react, your body reacts. And obviously people are socialized to believe that, you know, they're civilized. You know, they no longer depend on these animal instincts, when in reality, they do. So that's what's been happening recently for me, in a philosophical sense. I think because of that, you know, my travels around town, around Europe, around all these different places, it's meant that my career, my professional life, as a writer, as an actor, hasn't been getting as much attention as I maybe, perhaps, would have liked. Now, the reason acting hasn't been getting the attention, one might say it deserves, is because I left my previous acting agent for reasons pertaining to hashtag Me Too. Now, legal reasons do come in, and I think I'd have to do my research on whether I can actually talk about who this person is or what they did, but I can definitely say, head held up high, it was for reasons pertaining to hashtag Me Too. So I think leaving that behind, acting behind, for the time being, obviously I'm still a natural born performer, it meant that the whole system, this whole kind of pyramid, this whole patriarchy that you feed into, obviously you stick your cup underneath this tap and you drink from it, and that's what we call the actor's Kool-Aid. You start believing that the people at the top are really people who demand your respect, when actually a lot of them are ignorant fools who are there because of privilege, or there because they're ruthless. And of course there are magnificent artists who are in the acting industry as well. But you have to be aware that there are wonderful people, there are mediocre people, and there are bad people in those settings. There's no magical place called Oz. And being aware of that and having the agency to stand up for yourself and not take people's shit just because they might have some kind of power over you has been a really important stage for me in my young life of 25 years. And I think just taking the time to actually call that out. And I think the natural, next stage to that would be obviously to do the activism on social media that I have been doing, which is calling a whole wider world out that obviously affects the acting industry, because the acting industry exists within white supremacy. So that, having taken a break from that, I think has been healthy for me. But there is an itch to get back into it. And I think the world of Instagram is a big scratch. You know, oh, look at that big successful person. Look at that person successful person. There's this festival that you didn't do. There's this thing that's going on. And why aren't you doing this? And why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you busy? Because I definitely have the talent for it. I definitely have the resilience for it to live that famous, successful person's life. But I think every single day we need to honour how important every single phase that we go through is. I am eternally grateful for this time that I've had to really be in my thoughts, to really do my reading, to really conquer and combat the prevailing force of anti-blackness that sits within every single person who's raised in the Western world. And anti-blackness is, you know, I suppose we could call it a sub-category of racism. But, you know, I believe that racism now is, we need to use different words, because racism is a word that's been used so much that it's become trite. So I think anti-blackness is a really precise term for what we experience. And also a reason why when people talk about minority groups, they talk about black people and people of colour, black people being apart, because historically they have been treated worse than others, and have been the scapegoat for many different reasons and many different societies in this greater European world we live in. And I think combating that anti-blackness in myself has actually been interrogating the white friends I had surrounding me. So I think reading finally getting around to reading my first James Baldwin book, which was Giovanni's Room. And there's a passage at the beginning where he talks, well, the character talks about his relationship with his father and wanting to get away from his father. And I think that speaks to me a lot. I don't have a relationship with my father. I am estranged from that man. And really what was holding me back from reading those black writers was the fact that, one, they were not included in the canon, the official literary canon of my degree, which was Russian and Spanish. And we can actually say that both of those countries, maybe it's more obvious that Spanish-speaking countries have had a relationship, a historical relationship, good or bad, with African people, sub-Saharan African people. But actually, if we look at Russia, now that is a hidden history. Alexander Sergeyevich Pushkin, the greatest Russian writer to have ever lived, in the names of every single educator in the Russian Federation, was actually an octoroon. He was an eighth black, an eighth Ethiopian, an eighth African, an eighth Negro, an eighth nigger. And the interesting story of that was his great-grandfather, I think that would make it. Great-grandfather was a slave, enslaved by the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire and the Russian Empire were battling. I think when the Russians won a battle over the Ottoman Empire, the Ottomans offered this slave as a token of peace. This slave was actually quite brilliant. He's very clever. And he did so well that he was adopted into the Russian royal court. And he married a Russian aristocrat, had a mulatto child. That mulatto child had a quadroon, and then that quadroon had an octoroon, and that octoroon was Alexander Sergeyevich Pushkin. Now, that is something I would have liked to have learned from my degree, Russian and Spanish, that I got from UCL. But I didn't. I had to learn that from my own research, as is anything most of the time regarding the presence and the importance of black people in the contribution of history. Obviously, with the Spanish-speaking places, you know, you've got Colombia has a huge Afro-Latino population, Caribbean, obviously Brazil, they don't speak Spanish, so we're not going to include that here, but obviously. And I think being brainwashed, force-fed that, you know, people like Lev Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and I don't know, on the Spanish side, I don't know my authors very well. But being force-fed that these European, Eurocentric writers are the good and the great meant that my anti-blackness was, you know, it was given all the Kool-Aid that it needed to grow. And I think by me looking at people like Maya Angelou or James Baldwin or other figures from Black American history, people like Arthur Kitt, you know, I didn't know who they were. And I didn't have the desire to research them because I thought, no, I am busy learning the real canon and these people are just an offshoot. Obviously, I was speaking the words of the oppressor, of the white oppressor. And I think it's coming to terms with that. After a pretty awful run-in with the white male patriarch, this was a person who I formerly known, who I formerly addressed as my friend. I woke up in the morning afterwards, you know, having lost sleep, having their bellowing, fragile voice still in my head. I thought, what the hell can I know what I can do. What would Maya Angelou do? So I went on YouTube on my phone, lying in bed, and watched a Maya Angelou interview from 1984. And I just saw her divine femininity and her love of black people. She said in one instance, when I was growing up, I always thought that white people weren't even real people. I just thought they were a figment of imagination or something like that. And she was in her store, and black people would always be so polite, so friendly, so sweet. They'd say, hello, how you doing? How's the sister? Have a good evening now. But the white people, they'd always come into the store. They'd be so rude. They would be demanding my uncle around as though he was a servant. And I just thought, wow, those are just the worst people ever. They're so impolite, so unhappy. Those are not the kind of people I wanted to see. And with their white skin, she thought that they were see-through, that they were like these kind of paper cutouts, something like that. And seeing how she talks about white fragility as, you know, people are the defenders of their ignorance because their ignorance is a warm blanket that they don't want to let go of. Something like that, paraphrasing. Seeing how that woman in 1984 was speaking to a white interviewer and knowing how that I can use that to apply that to my own life now. Fuck, what a weapon. What a weapon. What a sword and a shield in the name of black power. And those are the sorts of voices that I've been exploring. And I've been around a lot of people who are older than me, black people, and same age, who have been able to access that stuff. And it just took me a little longer to really go into the heart of my anti-blackness and destroy that motherfucker. Going into the heart of darkness. So those are the sort of things that have been preoccupying me for the past few months. And, you know, I hope that this podcast will be interesting for people. People will be able to understand the mental thought processes going on in this little head, in this little caramel head of mine. But I think throughout all this, I think I'm a person who was diagnosed with ADD at the age of 19 in Birkenhead, where I was living. I was living in a place called Market Wells. It's a homeless shelter. I think they call it a foyer. Un foyer, on peut dire en français. Un foyer à la française. And that was where I was living because I was estranged from my mother and my father. My mother and my father have mental health issues. And after that, I was living with my auntie and her children and my uncle. So my auntie is from Kenya, my mother's sister. My two cousins are mulatto. And their father, obviously, is white. And I lived with them from the age of 16 until 18. But then I was told I had to leave at in around December 2012 due to certain members of my family having an issue with me. What do we call this? We call this the Cinderella effect. Guess who's Cinderella? And I went to live in this hostel. And around May 2013, so the spring after I'd moved in, December, Christmas time, in a hostel full of people who were poor. Were poor. I think if you were in America, they'd call them white trash. And living in a place like that, when you definitely had aspirations for something greater in life, was hard. Definitely flared up certain feelings. Hateful feelings. So, there was a doctor who came around to our hostel, and I was 19 by then. And he was diagnosing learning difficulties, ADHD, ADD, ADHD is what they called it, amongst the young homeless, the young and the homeless. And I got diagnosed with it. I remember after I'd been diagnosed with it, I went proudly into my French class and I said to them, listen, I have a diagnosis of ADHD. Je me rappelle, elle m'a répondu en français, she responded to me in French and said, il ne faut pas l'utiliser comme une excuse. You can't use that like an excuse, she said to me, when I said that it would make my ability to complete certain tasks, certain homework tasks, more difficult. And her first response was to say, this is not an excuse. Of course, what happened mostly what happens when we say these things to people is so they can be more empathetic. So they can... No, this bitch was not into that game. She's not into empathy. I had already been put in her books as a bad boy, as a bad kid who did not like authority. So she told me that I was using it as an excuse. And I think... looking at, and by the way, I'm really impressed that I've gone on this far. I would have X'd this a lot earlier in more recent years. I'm gonna go to half an hour, by the way. That's nice baby steps for my first podcast. So I have been having this a blessing, I don't know, something of the two. This ADD, this is something that has affected me. My life as a student, my life professionally. I think my friend sent to me a really interesting Instagram account, which shows the cycle of ADD sufferers, or ADD livers, survivors. And it goes like this. You come across something new. You think, okay, I'm good now. You put everything into it. You say yes to everything. You, as time goes on, as pressure builds, you begin to drop out. You begin to not do the tasks that are required of you. People don't understand, so you get even more anxious. This is something that, you know, would happen in school at the start in September. I'd be really good. I'd be the person who stands out. I answer all the questions, but then as the homework piles on, I don't have any support because society is inherently ableist. I then begin to lose motivation. I then begin to feel stressed. I then begin to feel anxious. And then I drop out of that. And then I quit. And I think that's what has happened with all these different things that I've tried. You know, my performance with Auntie, I did that at Edinburgh. I went for it. I killed it. I did my thing. I did everything on my own. Oh, I got back from Edinburgh and I just had to give up. I was too traumatized. I was too anxious. I was too exhausted. And I think that's where I am now. I know that there are lots of things that I'd like to do. There are lots of cultures that I'd like to exist. There are lots of languages I'd like to learn. There's lots of travels I'd like to make. But I'm just in this position now where I want to try everything, but I don't want to commit. Or maybe I'm fearful that I'm not able to commit. Or I don't know. Maybe I just don't feel like I have the correct support that I need in this society of ableism. But that's where I am now. And... obviously, in our highly connected world, we're constantly seeing people on our Instagrams doing something that's more impressive than us, just doing something that is something that we'd like to do, but we can't. But because I feel so split and want to do so many things, there's so many people that I can compare myself to. I can compare myself to musicians, I can compare myself to models, I can compare myself to actors, I can compare myself to linguists, I can compare myself to teachers, I can compare myself to visual artists, I can compare myself to... so many things, activists, philosophers, writers, all of these things that I have an interest in, that I want to succeed in, but I can't do everything at the same time. So here I am. Now we are getting close, and I'm getting excited, because I get to run away and stop doing this scary thing! I'm going to find a correct platform for posting this on. But here I am, and I am excited for the next stage. I'm excited to see where I can really put these talents to use, because I got a plan. I got a whole shed full. I got plenty to go around. So I think for the last minute, I'd probably just like to talk about nothing. Nothing at all. I'm going to sing you a song. Loving you is easy because you're beautiful. And everything that I do is all from loving you. La 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 la. Oh, la 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 la. Oh, la 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 la
Oh, let's cut it down. Okay. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. This has been my first podcast. This is Gavina Davino. I hope you enjoyed it. Bye-bye.